Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Tens of millions of Americans lost their jobs in the pandemic. Fortunately, we have a system to help. Unemployment insurance. Unfortunately, for millions of people, that system has not worked.
I've been 4 months trying to get unemployment cleared in the state of California and have gotten nowhere. I've been on the phone a number of times with them. Nothing moves up the food chain. It's just, it's in process.
I was laid off, furloughed in June, and I was paid last week. So I went through quite the headache for it.
The phone numbers take you only to poor people answering phones that can't assist you. They will not accept any kind of evidence, and they offer hearing date without any way to basically get a hearing date.
You cannot get access to anybody about anything to find out what's going on.
Well, that's Lydia from Dayton, Ohio, Molly from Massachusetts, Stephen from Columbus, Ohio, and John from Santa Cruz, California. Just a few of the people who reached out to us to talk about how hard it's been to get unemployment insurance. So this hour, we're going to be taking a look at why. Why so many people have faced long waits or are still waiting for their benefits. So let's start today with something of an unemployment success story. I mean, I guess we could sort of call it a success story. Cleo Chang is a freelance journalist based in Brooklyn, and she was, in fact, writing about the unemployment crisis when she herself got laid off from Vice in May. So, Cleo, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay. So, first of all, I do want to just, I want to hear a little bit from you about the sort of the depths to which you had familiarized yourself with the systems of unemployment before Vice laid you off. I mean, what exactly was the reporting that you were doing?
Yeah. So, when the recession happened at Vice, you know, we sort of turned our attention to this unemployment crisis, and I was doing a lot of reporting with my team, mostly just calling people who are going through the system and having issues, you know, getting through, applying, people who are calling hundreds of times a day, also talking to, you know, policy experts and unemployment lawyers about, you know, what was happening and sort of the rollout of the government's, the federal government's pandemic unemployment assistance program. So yeah, and one thing we did was we called all 50 offices, unemployment offices in all 50 states to just sort of demonstrate how we couldn't get through to almost anyone and talk to a real person.
You said that only two people actually picked up in
all 50
states that you called.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm laughing because of the absurdity of it, but it's also true. So here you are, you've spent quite a bit of time reporting on this very system of unemployment. You've got this knowledge, you've talked to experts, and then bang, you lose your job. So at first were you like, okay, well, I should be able to manage this?
Yeah, I mean, I had jokingly told my editor, I was like, it's good that we're doing all this reporting because, you know, when we get laid off, we'll know what to do. And then when I got laid off, I was like, oh, great, I actually feel like I know what to do. And I thought it would actually be a pretty straightforward situation since I was laid off from a W-2 job. And I figured it might take some time with the backlogs and stuff. But I, you know, I thought it would be simple, and it ended up not being that way.
And I feel like this is yet another lesson the pandemic is teaching us. Every time we think things are going to be simple, the answer is like, no, it will not. So what happened? I mean, also you had union representation as well. So ideally guidance from your union reps and lawyers to help you through this process. So what happened? Where did you first go to file for unemployment?
So basically, you know, I filed online and we spoke to our union lawyers and they helped us sort of with the application process and questions we might have. And everything was very simple from there. And I think it was maybe like after a month or so of not hearing anything, I started to be like, okay, well, you know, what's going on? And then my other like former coworkers started getting their applications approved and their money, and I was the only one who wasn't. So I was like, okay, something is specifically up with my claim. And I try to get in touch with the DOL, which is, you know, a very difficult thing to do. I was told that, you know, DMing them on Twitter would be the easiest way.
Wait, hang on. This is for the New York Department of Labor.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Who, who told you that sending a Twitter DM is the best way to get a hold of them?
I attended a webinar on unemployment for freelancers, which was also a webinar that I helped organize, and it was unemployment lawyer people's questions, and he had suggested that that was a way to quickly get in touch with the DOL. And so I tried it, and they took my name and said they would call me back. They didn't call me back for a long time, but I also found in some Facebook groups that the actually easiest way is to call Governor Cuomo's office, and someone there will wire you into the DOL, and that's actually the quickest way. And that actually, I found that that was the way I got in contact with them. After a couple tries, I managed to talk to someone. You know, they said that my claim was, I wasn't eligible, and they were going to put me, they were going to have me apply to pandemic unemployment assistance, which is for self-employed people. So I had been freelancing before I had a W-2 job. And basically, it was a lot of like back and forth of confusion of what I should be doing and what I should be applying for. And then in the end, I mean, there's a lot more steps in between, but I ended up, I thought I would actually have to reapply for regular employment. That wasn't the case. I was talking to some, you know, policy friends about it, and they suggested that. And then in the end, the DOL actually called me, returning my Twitter DM from early June. And this was in August.
Okay. I actually want to hear about some of the steps in between, because I'm going to use this word absurd a lot, but it's also reality. So first of all, just underscore Twitter DM, and then you, and then you were told to call the governor's office, and they put you in touch or some kind of list with the New York State Department of Labor. Okay. And then it took a while before you could actually get someone at the DOL on the phone. And I'm looking at a story you wrote about here, and it said that the first time you talked to someone at the Department of Labor, they couldn't get their computer to work, so you were put back on hold. Like, I actually do want to hear some of these details. Like, what are these things that happened? Yeah.
Yeah, so I called, and they, you know, this person was like, I'm so sorry, I can't get my computer to work. I'm going to put you back on the hold line. It'll only be like 2 or 3 minutes. And I was like, great. Like, I'm just connected. I'm fine. And, you know, I was actually a little nervous that for some reason my service would drop out or something would happen. But I was like, it's okay. And then I got put back on hold and actually took like way longer. It took more than an hour. Got back with someone else to talk about my claim. And they told me that my claim had been rejected, which I had no idea. Like, I didn't receive anything in the mail. And they said that I had to apply for pandemic unemployment. And then they asked me the application questions for pandemic unemployment on the phone. And, you know, they're not very straightforward, some of them. Like, so for example, they asked me if my workplace had closed due to COVID. And I was, you know, asking them, I was like, well, you know, vice offices are still open. I was laid off, like, but so the offices aren't actually like closed because of COVID, but I was laid off because of, you know, the COVID recession. And they couldn't really explain anything to me. And they were like, well, where do you work now when you can work? And I said, well, I'm a freelancer. I work from home, right? I work from my desk in my bedroom. And then they just repeated the question, like, did your office close because of COVID? And
you're I work from home.
Yeah. I was like, well, no, like, are you asking me if my home closed from COVID? And they just asked me the question again. And I think like, and I said, no, like my office didn't close from COVID. And, you know, I'm sitting at my desk right now in my bedroom. I'm like, it's open because I live here. But
this is starting to sound like a Sartre novel, I have to say. Okay. And but you somewhere in there, you said that you had been rejected, but you didn't know.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's two types of unemployment, right? There's regular unemployment, which is like, you know, if you have a W-2 job, you know, you're laid off, like that's the sort of unemployment we think of normally. And then there's pandemic unemployment, which is the new federal government's program for self-employed, that includes self-employed workers, right? So I was rejected from regular and thought I would be accepted into pandemic. And actually in the end, that is what happened. But I went kind of back and forth for a while. I was confused.
Oh, okay. You were confused, and you had already done all this reporting on how the system was supposed to work. I mean, as you're sitting there waiting for the phone calls that never get returned or you're on infinite hold, did you think to yourself, like, how are people who, you know, didn't get a chance to talk to experts for a while, like, navigating this?
Oh, my gosh. Like, every day I was like, I don't understand. Because I was very convinced that I was eligible, right? Like, I sort of knew that actually I thought I could be eligible under either. And I had people who I spoke to who like confirmed that to me, you know, policy experts and stuff, who were like, yes, like you should be able to get these benefits. And if I didn't have that sort of knowledge or just people telling me that, like I definitely would have given up, I think, much longer ago. And, you know, I was very fortunate in the fact that I had savings. Like I, you know, I had like a stable internet connection, and like that was even one thing that people I spoke to, you know, someone said they didn't have a computer at home. So they're like, these sites don't work on mobile. And so it's really hard for me to do anything. And just like all these things that are not people's fault that could be like small roadblocks. I just like, I couldn't believe like how difficult it was for me.
But in this case, small roadblocks are just like a full stop in terms of progressing through this completely confusing system. So how many days did it take for you to receive your first check?
So 98 days from filing to getting my first check. So 90, almost 4 months.
98 days. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the state of New York isn't one of the ones that's frequently held up as having a hot mess of a system, but what you're describing is a hot mess. So, I mean, have you been able to talk to New York State officials as to what's going on?
I mean, I haven't spoken to New York State officials, but just, you know, from reporting that I've read, the system itself is super antiquated. They are revamping it as we speak, but it's also like a very outdated like tech infrastructure, as most of them are across the country.
Uh-huh. Now, we're looking this hour. Your experience is the springboard that we're using to ask this bigger question about, well, it's so hard for people. Is this just bureaucratic ineptitude, or is it on purpose?
I mean, I think the answer is both.
The answer is both.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, the answer is definitely both. I think you know, these systems are super underfunded, and a lot of that is on purpose, right? I think our country makes it difficult for people to get benefits. The whole point is that you have to prove that you're qualified rather than, you know, being eligible. And then, you know, later, maybe if that doesn't work out, they take it away. Yeah. But just like the system is set up to
make it hard.
Like, yeah, make it hard.
Well, Cleo Chang is a freelance journalist. She was laid off from Vice in May. Her story about what it took for her to get unemployment insurance, we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Cleo, thank you. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about the purgatory of unemployment insurance, or seeking unemployment insurance in this country. We heard from a lot of listeners about this. For example, here's On Point listener Joy, who called us from Georgia. And Joy described how the system was working for her family until it wasn't.
My husband was furloughed back in March for 3 months. And at the end of July, he was let go, laid off permanently. He was in the airline industry. And we thought it was going to be easy because he was already receiving unemployment, and that's not so. We had to go back and file a whole new claim, and we've been at it since the end of July, and we've received nothing. He's already in the system. He's been receiving checks, but the minute that the employer quit filing for us, we're on our own.
So that's Joy. She and her family have been trying to navigate the unemployment insurance system, the maze, for months. But people who recently, just say in the past couple of weeks, have lost their jobs and are trying to get in to their state system, they're finding problems right now, too. Here's Kayon, who filed for unemployment 2 weeks ago. She said she wasn't laid off directly due to the pandemic, but her application has still faced some delays. She didn't hear anything back from the state of Georgia until last week. And even then, that was only an email that she received saying that they had received her application, but it has still not been processed.
Technically, likely. My company housed me under someone who was not laid off as a direct result of COVID, but because I was laid off during that time, I have not been able to receive unemployment benefits because I'm in the state of Georgia. They are yet to make a determination on my claim from July. It'll be 2 months next week.
So that's Kayon from Georgia, who was, as she said, laid off 2 months ago. Well, joining us now is Pamela Hurd, professor of public policy at Georgetown University and author of Administrative Burden, Policymaking by Other Means. Professor Hurd, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So out of all fairness, first of all, let me start with this question. The pandemic was historic. The amount of almost instantaneous unemployment it created was historic. 40 million Americans at one point in time. Are the bureaucratic slog that Americans have had to go through to navigate unemployment insurance systems, is that an outcome of the unprecedented sort of spasm of demand on these systems that they had never seen before?
Yeah, I mean, in part, for sure. These state systems were geared up to manage more regular levels of unemployment, or even like during the Great Recession, when you had more gradual increases in unemployment, rather than the sort of massive and sudden demand. So that made a big difference. The other thing I think to point out for at the state level, at least in terms of the bureaucratic responsibility at the state level, is that the federal government, on top of this unprecedented demand, required states to start up an entirely new program, which is this sort of pandemic-related unemployment insurance with all new types of eligibility categories and, of course, different benefit levels with a $600 additional benefit. So these were programs that were already going to be strained, even if they had done nothing to change the existing UI system. But then on top of it, the feds really made it a lot more complicated for the states. Mm-hmm. That said, the state programs, and this does vary by state, as you sort of noted in your last segment, in many ways, these state programs were designed to make it difficult for people to access them. So there's certainly culpability here, both at the state and federal level in terms of what happened.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to spend a lot of time talking about that culpability here. But I want to, in order to sort of understand why certain states have intentionally designed these systems to be difficult, let's actually get some historical context first, if we could. So Social Security emerges out of the New Deal, right? And can you just give us a quick reminder, was unemployment insurance part of the New Deal vision of packages or social safety net that emerged at that time?
Absolutely. The two biggest programs or most central programs to emerge from the New Deal are Social Security and unemployment insurance. And it's interesting in a way because you can see those programs took really different paths. So Social Security became a federally run program, and it grew and grew over the course of the 20th century to become kind of our largest, most popular, and most effective poverty reduction program. It's also really easy for beneficiaries to navigate that program. It's really easy to access your benefits, basically, at least on the retirement side. Unemployment insurance, however, they decided to run as a state program. Now, this was a debate for Social Security as well. There were debates for both programs, whether they should be run by the states or run by the federal government. But for unemployment insurance, they went with a state-run program, largely due to arguments that wages and labor conditions varied so much by state, it'd be really difficult to have like a single federal policy. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, Southern states, for example, Southern Democrats didn't want Northern states telling them how to set their benefit levels and how to set eligibility. So it was just a political non-starter that this would be a federally run program. But that decision, I think in retrospect, and if you look at the evolution of the unemployment insurance program, was really pivotal in terms of what made it incredibly complicated and honestly not particularly effective and dysfunctional. And I'll just make one last point, which is one really important point here is the kind of race part of this. Mm-hmm. which is that one of the reasons, for example, why Southern states wanted to control their unemployment in programs was because they didn't want to have to distribute benefits or especially large benefits to Black people in the low-wage labor sector in the South. And to this day, Black American workers are both less likely to receive unemployment insurance and more likely to be unemployed. And indeed, the states with the largest fraction of Black workers in the labor force also have kind of the lowest levels and kind of worst, most poorly designed UI systems.
So tell me more. Why about the Black Americans are less likely to receive unemployment assistance? Presumably those are amongst the people who have applied for it to begin with, or is it that they are less likely to apply? Why is that? What's happening there?
Yeah, so it's a mixture of different things. So one thing to remember about the unemployment insurance system is we effectively have 50 odd different programs throughout the United States. So if you live in California or Massachusetts, your unemployment insurance looks really different than if you live in Florida or North Carolina. For example, the maximum benefit in Massachusetts is somewhere around $1,200 a week, whereas the maximum benefit in Florida in the traditional UI program is like $275. And then the eligibility even for the program varies quite a lot. So for example, in Massachusetts, prior to the pandemic, somewhere around 60% of those who were unemployed received benefits, compared to about 10% of those unemployed in the state of Florida. And basically, the issue is that in the states where most Black workers are, they look more like Florida's system than Massachusetts' system.
I see. But it sounded like you were saying a little earlier, is there's an intentionality in that, and that race has to do in part with that intention to make it more difficult?
Well, clearly there's a lot of good evidence to support that contention that states, so you see this throughout social welfare programs, actually, the states that are where Black Americans live tend to have in state-run programs, tend to have much more restrictive and punitive kind of social welfare benefits, for example. So you just sort of see this sort of consistency across these programs that disproportionately hurts Black Americans. So it's sort of hard to step away and say that somehow that has nothing to do with race, especially when in the origins of these programs, for example, in UI, The Black Americans were largely just completely ineligible for both Social Security and UI in the origins of the program because they were largely domestic and agricultural workers. Those workers were excluded from being included in those programs. And while there are claims, for example, that administrative factors explain why, like it was just difficult administratively to enroll agricultural and domestic workers, the reality is that the people implementing those programs were clear to say, no, we can do this. We can manage this. And then if you compare Social Security and unemployment insurance, Social Security did eventually include domestic and agricultural workers around 1950. UI has never particularly effectively covered both of those classes of workers. So race definitely has something to do with it.
This comes up over and over and over again about how, to put it bluntly, racial animosity in this country actually has led to systems that that hurt everybody. Like it's making it harder for everybody in some of these states.
That is exactly correct. Yes. And I think that was the interesting thing for me listening to a lot of these stories is that, for example, the reporter you interviewed in the last segment, right? Mm-hmm. Like there are a lot of people now experiencing the unemployment insurance who have never experienced it before. And they're getting a real dose of how painful that experience can be. That's right.
How different is this from other industrialized nations?
We definitely have kind of one of the most restrictive and one of the most dysfunctional unemployment insurance systems in the developed world, basically. Yeah, no, it is. We have fewer people eligible. We have lower benefits. We restrict the amount of time they can be on the program. They're just less effective systems. And if you think actually about the pandemic response, interestingly enough, a lot of other developed countries, instead of kind of trying to funnel or manage unemployment through their unemployment insurance systems, what they did instead was a really simple approach, was basically guaranteed that they would cover salary for workers. So people effectively weren't laid off at all. So if you look at the UK right now, for example, their unemployment rate, I think, is somewhere under 5% still right now, where ours is, I believe, still 13 or 14%.
Mm-hmm.
So really different approaches.
we had a slight version of that, right, with the PPP program, but it wasn't sort of the overwhelming thrust of the federal government's response.
No, and it was also administered in a way that it was sort of designed to fail. You had this influx of all these different businesses trying to access those benefits. Similar, interestingly enough, right, similar kinds of experiences that people trying to get UI had, crashing websites, a lack of clarity exactly about who would be eligible for it. And then particularly with that program, you saw, for example, a lot of small business owners and particularly Black-owned businesses who were just unable to get those loans. So administratively, not well implemented.
Yeah. Professor Hurd, I honestly have to say I'm waiting for you to say one good thing about the system that we have, if at all, for providing unemployment benefits to people. I mean, could you point to one good thing?
Well, I do want to be a little bit careful here, because the expansions that they did to the program during the pandemic, the addition of all these workers who typically had not been covered in UI before, the $600 additional benefit, these were critical, critical economic security mechanisms. I mean, I would argue we could have done that a lot better, but it's really good that they did it mm-hmm. at all. Mm-hmm. And it's a real problem, right, that we're rolling that back now. Because think about a state like Florida, for example. Your maximum benefit is $275 a week. That $600 benefit was critical for people in those states who did manage to get UI. So, on the one hand, there were huge administrative failures here. The program really needs to be reinvigorated and improved. But I don't want to imply that many of the changes that they made in the end are actually incredibly important, and that we should just move forward and try to fix a lot of what they've done.
That's a really important point here, right? Because we are in the middle of a historic emergency, right? So the actions that were taken were lifesavers for millions of people. And at the same time, as you're saying, okay, this is also a moment to critically analyze the very systems that we're relying on, even in the best of times, to see how they work and must be improved. I do have a question about you're describing a 50 different systems that are rife with inefficiencies that make it hard, whether by design or by accident, for people to get unemployment insurance. What impact does that have? I mean, we know what impact it has on individuals. It makes their lives miserable. But what impact do those efficiencies have more broadly, say, on the labor market itself?
Well, I guess I'd speak mostly to the pandemic right now, actually, in answering that question, which, right, if you want to control a pandemic, you don't want people who are sick going to work. You don't want to force people into work environments where they're both more likely to get the virus and also pass that virus on. So, one of the things that's been a real problem with this system, if you're trying to think about the control of a pandemic, is that we've definitely undermined ourselves, because we've made it pretty hard for people to make good choices about trying to control the pandemic, because the unemployment insurance system, like the money that people need just to get by, make it really actually hard for them to just sort of stop working if they need to or should stop working because of the pandemic.
Well, I want to just sneak in a little bit of tape here. This is from Molly, who lives in Massachusetts, and she doesn't blame the people working for the state's unemployment agencies. Here's what Molly said.
The women on the phone so far that have answered the phone, two of them have broken into sobs and tell me how utterly frustrated they are that they can't help anyone. And there's nothing that can be done.
Wow. So that's Molly from Massachusetts talking about the people who are at the unemployment agency in the state of Massachusetts breaking into sobs because they can't even move the system along faster than they need to. So we are talking this hour about why there are so many deep inefficiencies in the 50 different systems of unemployment insurance we have in this country, what impact that's having on the millions of Americans who are unemployed right now and have been waiting for unemployment benefits from their state, and what we can do about it. We're talking today with Pamela Hurd. She's a professor of public policy at Georgetown and author of Administrative Burden, Policymaking by Other Means. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow, we will be talking with campus leaders from colleges and universities across the country about the challenges they are facing this semester, this first pandemic semester. So are you a college student who's back on campus? What has that been like? Or are you at home because school is all virtual? We want to know if you decided to take the year off because of the pandemic or if you're plunging ahead with whatever campus looks like for you. Give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show on colleges and this first semester. Today, we are talking about unemployment insurance and how the varied systems of getting that unemployment insurance in the 50 states of the United States can be extremely confusing, labyrinthine, virtually impossible to navigate, and why that is. And we're talking today with Pamela Hurd. She's a professor of public policy at Georgetown University and author of Administrative Burden, Policymaking by Other Means. And Pam, should we talk about Florida?
Yeah, a little bit. It's hard not to talk about Florida, right?
Okay, yeah. So in order to set up our focus on here now on Florida, I actually want to just hear a little story from a Floridian. Okay, so this is Denise Mines. She's a university librarian who lives in Boynton Beach, Florida. She was furloughed from that job on April 17th, and the first thing she did, she followed all of the steps to get her unemployment benefits in Florida. And it should have been pretty easy, or at least this video from the Florida Department of Economic Opportunity makes it sound straightforward.
The Florida Department of Economic Opportunity presents the guide for requesting your reemployment assistance benefit payments. Claimants will need to return to the Connect system every 2 weeks to request benefits. Completing this process submits your request for payment during your weeks of unemployment, even if your claim is...
Okay, but for Denise, things did not go as planned.
I was furloughed on April 17th. My dean called and said that many of the librarians in our system were being furloughed. She did say that I would be eligible for unemployment insurance through the state. I thought that since I was in one of the first waves of people being laid off or furloughed, that maybe I would get my application in under the gun. I assumed it would be a few weeks before my checks started coming.
Let's walk through the steps to request your reemployment assistance benefit payments in your Connect account. First, go to floridajobs.org, then scroll up to the top right icon reading.
I first tried to do the paperwork online, and when that would not complete adequately, I printed out the forms, and I saw that Federal Express was sending the forms for free to Tallahassee. So after I completed my forms manually, I put them in an envelope and I took them to Federal Express. Then after that, I just waited. And a few weeks later, I got my first set of checks, $275 from the state and $600 of the federal money. Mission accomplished. Then I got a very cryptic form that indicated that something was not right with my paperwork. So I sent back in a copy of my letter from my dean saying that I was furloughed, and a copy of my W-2 from the last year. And I sent that by mail and by fax. And I didn't really hear anything, but a week or two later, I got one more check, the $275 from the state. And since then, I haven't received any money. I sent everything back a second time and then a third time. And I tried doing different things like different color envelopes and writing funny things on the outside of the envelope so that maybe somebody would open it. But I never heard from anybody. These letters said to go on the website and try to resolve the claim. But I couldn't do that because they had never set up my claim properly. And when I would put in my email or my social security number, it would say it wasn't set up. So I wasn't able to go in. There was a little man walking across the screen telling you how long it was going to take until you were allowed to speak with someone virtually through the website. There was one time that I got through, I think it was on the phone, and she said that she had to push me up to a higher manager. But she stayed on the phone with me while we waited for this higher manager, and we waited 2 hours, and then I lost the call. I felt like I was an invisible person, and I really hoped that somebody was getting their unemployment insurance, but how could it be that I sent letter after letter after letter and nobody responded to me? I'm still sending letters because I still believe I'm owed compensation from the state. I believe I'm owed somewhere around $11,000. I've been working for over 40 years and I've been paying into the unemployment system all that time. And I feel that now it's time for me to get some of it back.
Well, Denise was actually able to return to her job in August, but by then she'd already lost about a quarter of her annual salary. She's a librarian at Kaiser University, and of course there's a lot of uncertainty with campus life right now. So we asked Denise one last question. What will she do, or would she do, if she's furloughed again?
If I got furloughed again, I would probably take the time to drive up to Tallahassee from South Florida and hand deliver my application to a human.
That's Denise Mines. She lives in Boynton Beach, Florida. Professor Hurd, what is going on in the state of Florida?
Well, one thing I want to say is it's important to understand Florida isn't alone in this, in the sense that post-Great Recession, Florida was not the only state to really try to ramp down and restrict their unemployment insurance program. Florida, has received a lot of attention, in part because it's a big state, there's a lot of people, and there's a real way in which people have been pretty clear about why this happened. So, for example, an advisor to Governor DeSantis made clear that the changes to the unemployment insurance system were not about saving money. This is a quote. It was about making it harder for people to get benefits or keep benefits so that the unemployment numbers were low to give this governor something to brag about. Now, I think what's important to note here, right, this is a Republican talking about another Republican.
Yeah. So, well, can I just jump in here? Because, I mean, yeah. Governor DeSantis also just relatively recently, just last month, straightforwardly said what he thought the unemployment system was all about. He was on CBS Miami with Jim DeFede talking about the state's unemployment system. And here is what DeFede asked Governor DeSantis.
Do you believe that the system was in part put together the way it was to discourage people from being able to collect unemployment?
I think that was the animating philosophy. I mean, having studied how it was internally constructed, I think the goal was, for whoever designed it, was let's put as many kind of pointless roadblocks along the way so people just say, oh, the hell with it. I'm not going to do that.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis just last month. Animating philosophy, whoever designed it. Well, Pamela Heard, who did design it?
Yeah, so this was under, obviously, Governor Rick Scott, or former Governor Rick Scott, and this is exactly what happened. They wanted to save money, so there were estimates that they would save businesses somewhere more than $2.3 billion, and so they wanted to save some money, and this was the mechanism they chose to do it, which was just effectively to make the unemployment insurance really difficult to navigate so that people couldn't access benefits. And lo and behold, it becomes a cheaper system. You know, they made the forms more complicated and confusing. They made the online portion of it really difficult to navigate. You know, they just made it tougher to navigate as a mechanism to reduce the number of people on the program.
I'm so glad that I'm on the radio and not television, because my face right now is kind of this mess of knots and confusion. Why would a state do this? I mean, you talked about reducing unemployment numbers for political gain, and does it also weaponizing bureaucracy? Does that also actually does it save the state money? I mean, ultimately, people are gonna need support somehow. I mean, I'm missing a piece of the picture here, I think.
Well, I mean, that's a hard question to answer in a way. You know, I mean, surely it saved businesses quite a lot of money, right? It saved businesses quite a lot of money because they had to pay lower taxes to the UI system. Uh-huh. So I think that's a part of the piece of the puzzle here. Florida in general does not have an especially generous social welfare system. So if you can't access DUI, trying to access other social welfare benefits, well, they're fairly restrictive in Florida. Maybe you can access food stamps, which is funded by the federal government, though not by the state government. So yeah, no, I think it's a lot about saving money. And I think for a long time, right, they got away with this because effectively unemployment rates were pretty low, and not enough people were kind of encountering this morass to complain. But now you have millions of people encountering these systems, and they're rightfully mad. But the point I want to make is it's really not just about Florida. So, for example, if you look at Wisconsin, it's received a lot less attention, but there were similar things that went on in Wisconsin under GOP Governor Scott Walker. He made a big push to change a lot of administrative procedures in the Wisconsin unemployment insurance system that made it much harder to navigate, that made it forms more confusing, that pushed a lot of people to make misstatements basically on forms so they can get accused of providing misinformation. And big picture, for example, in Wisconsin, the fraction of unemployed people receiving unemployment insurance in Wisconsin fell from 50% in 2007 to 32% in 2016. So a 20 percentage point reduction in the fraction of unemployed receiving unemployment insurance benefits in the state of Wisconsin. So it's not just Florida.
It's not just Florida. Professor Heard, you know, it's not just Florida. Point taken. It doesn't actually make me feel any better. because underlying what you're describing here actually is that for many political leaders across this country, the systems that they have that aren't working for the unemployed residents of their state, they would say, actually, that's evidence that the system they want, the political leaders say, it is working. It's achieving the goals that they want, those lower taxes, the lower, official unemployment rate. I mean, there is a powerful group of political leaders who say, this is actually what we want to have happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think the concern is the if I could use the term, the sort of nefarious way that people are going about doing it. Because the fact of the matter is, Florida is unusual in how explicit they're saying that they're explicitly they're saying now, yeah, we just put these in, we put these administrative barriers in place so that people wouldn't get benefits. They're being super explicit right now. Typically, they're not quite so explicit. And instead, for example, in Wisconsin, what you hear instead is, we want to reduce fraud rates. So we're going to really, you know, make these administrative changes because we're trying to reduce fraud. Or we're going to try really hard to make sure that people who are on unemployment get off it and get reemployed. But what you see instead, for example, the latter, this is another thing that went on in a lot of states. It's not just hard to get on UI, it's hard to keep it because you have to keep demonstrating that you're still eligible, and particularly you have to demonstrate that you're looking for work. And a lot of states made that part of the process harder, like the you're actually looking for work part of the process mm-hmm. harder. And so, for example, there's one program that they implemented. Wisconsin was one of the states that implemented this, the reemployment program, where theoretically they were trying to help people get reemployed. But in reality, they just created a lot of additional administrative obstacles. You had to go to the state to meet with someone, so on and so forth. And what you found basically, an external evaluation of that program found that about half of the people who lost their benefits in that program lost their benefits not because they got reemployed, but because they messed up the navigation of the administrative obstacles.
Okay, so we've just got 2 minutes left here, Pam. And our mantra on Point since March has been, you know, the pandemic is a mirror. The pandemic is a mirror. Again, tip of the hat to Anne Applebaum for giving us that language. It's holding up the reflection of what, you know, this society actually is. And many more of us are seeing it for the first time, to be perfectly honest. So could the fact that so many millions more Americans now are like, wow, these systems are very, very hard to navigate, some of them deliberately so. Could this be a moment to also catalyze change or calls for improving those systems? And if so, how would we do that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think bigger picture, right? UI and a bunch of other social welfare programs are designed in ways to keep people off rather than to ensure that people who are actually eligible get on them. And bigger picture, we need to reshape the way we think about some of these programs like unemployment insurance so that we focus a lot more on really ensuring that the people who paid in, the people who are eligible, the people who need these benefits get them and design administrative processes around that goal. And in fact, we can do it. We've done it. If you look at the Social Security Retirement Program, for example, it's an incredibly well-run program on that dimension. There's very little fraud, almost no fraud, but pretty much everyone who's eligible gets those benefits. We need to reimagine social welfare programs, other social welfare programs, so that they do the same thing. And I would sort of add, how do we get there? Well, part of it is people have to complain. You know, I'm listening in Wisconsin in particular because I lived in Wisconsin. I mean, all legislators, both Republican and Democrat, are getting an earful from their constituents about these programs. And people have to keep doing that if they want these programs to change.
Well, Pamela Hurd is a professor of public policy at Georgetown University and author of Administrative Burden, Policymaking by Other Means. Professor Hurd, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.